give and give and give. Soon you will realize that self-giving is not a most difficult task. Sri Chinmoy. Chapter 14, Self-Transcendence. Although the accommodation in New York was always clean and warm, I soon rented a more permanent room. That way I could go when I liked and have my own wooden cot bed instead of a mat on the floor. There were 4 spaces available, so I shared with 2 workmates from Wales and the girl who had sat behind me in the Albert Hall. She worked at Runnymede Cum in London and sang in Temple Songhearts, so I knew her well and always felt drawn to her company. Our 2 birthdays were a few days apart, and our artist friend had hers in the same week, so the 3 of us decided to make an extra visit to America that year between celebrations. People often visited the master for their birthdays. Sri Chinmoy called the birthday the soul's day. According to him, the soul comes to us that day to remind us of our life's purpose and of the promise we made in heaven before being born into the trammels of the earth and the amnesia of human life. It was thus a time for meditation and soulful reflection, as well as festivities twice as sugary and gift-laden as any in my childhood. There was to be a celebration of Sri Chinmoy's weightlifting achievements, which happened to fall on the evening before my birthday. I had decided to offer watermelon as prasad and arrived at Aspiration Ground in time to prepare it beneath a little awning by the gate. It was the first time I had ever been by myself there. Only 1 or 2 were setting up inside. I was in my own private world under the honeyed sun of evening, slicing through thick green rind and ripe redness, absorbed by the scent and simple movement. When I already could not have been happier, my guru arrived early and passed me at my work with a smile. Just after 10, the function ended, so the master called for prasad. As the crates were carried out in long procession, he read aloud a list of the items and the names of those who had given them. There were 4 birthdays altogether, that day and the next. Sometimes he would invite those who had been disciples for at least 7 years to come and meditate with him for a few moments on their soul's day. I had only been a disciple 5 years, but the master called all 4 of us to stand in a line before him. Although mine was the following day, I was born just after 3 in the morning, so it was the exact time of my birth in Britain. "Which one is from Wales?" My hand crept upwards. "Oh, that girl." I did not know what to make of his comment, but there was no time to wonder anyway. I was 6 feet in front of him trying to summon my best meditation. Half reclining on a soft blue chair with an even softer blue blanket draped over the back, he smiled gently with his eyes almost completely closed. I wondered how I would know the turn had come for my blessing, but when it did come, I was left in no doubt. It had the force and fullness of an ocean wave. It was all I could do to remain standing. On the last of our 3 birthdays, the artist had to leave early, so only 2 of us remained. We wandered around the Divine Enterprises, buying treats and gifts for each other and for our friends at home, ending up at Oneness Fountain Heart restaurant for lunch. It was one of those immaculate days when the sun shines from inside and out, a day when one asks for the dessert menu. As we were doing just that, the phone rang behind the desk. Even ice cream lost its interest when the waiter handed the receiver to my companion. After a moment of silence, she covered her mouth, but still made a noise louder than would normally be heard in a restaurant. Although it seemed to be good news, I was not sure until a while after the phone was set back in its cradle. Sri Chinmoy had invited both of us to join Pari's group. The master was offering a concert for disciples the next morning in a garden some drive away. There was to be a race and a picnic afterwards, just like a joy day. He arrived in a striking imperial purple dhoti, the like of which I had never seen, I realized then that every color seemed to suit him perfectly, however soft or bold. We sat on rugs and scarves in the cool grass of early morning and meditated with him while the sun climbed trees. He played Esrange for half an hour. The strings themselves seemed to cry with a mixture of joy and longing. Then Pari's group sang, nine of us in a line, we two newcomers at either end. By chance that placed me next to my guru as he rested under a wide umbrella. It was all too real to be a dream, and far sweeter than any dream I could have conceived. The master was back in his grandfatherly form for the afternoon. There were stories and games and barbecues and heaped up dishes of things like potato salad or buttery corn on the cob. We stayed until the shadows yawned and stretched. My cheeks were brushed with sunshine and ached from so much smiling. Even by August, I was still half convinced there had been a mistake, that I would come to sing in the morning and be politely sent back again, back behind the diaphanous screen of etiquette from whence I came. 40 of us followed in one line as Sri Chinmoy passed beside the open arena of aspiration ground, then around a small stone fountain of lilies and into a space known as the Gully. Gully seemed to me a plain name for a place of such hallowed enchantment, a channel of tall woodland with a red strip of athletic track running at its base. There was a gentle haze broken by dapples and sparkled shafts of light. Under that secret canopy, it seemed even the highest leaves did not turn restless in the breezes, but fell yellow and silent about us, like strips torn off the sun, extinguishing their blaze in shadow. Time itself seemed to renounce its sovereignty. We stood in four lines offset from one another, so each group could choose a different song. The girl at the furthest end would start, and when that song ended, the next would begin a new one straight away. So all the while, four remote melodies could be discerned at varying distance. Where he once would have trained for sprinting, the master took his exercise then at a brisk walk, with stiff and often bandaged knees, his ears only inches from our Godwood songs, his eyes almost closed or half open to confer a blessing as he strode by again and again. I strove for an ever new perfection, searching for a word forgotten, reaching my hearing as wide as it would go, honing the level and pitch of my own sound to weave it seamlessly into the whole, emptying my mind of the strange banal thoughts that had somehow followed me into that paradise. We filed into aspiration ground, where hundreds had taken their seats. A microphone was brought out and Sri Chinmoy asked for each of us to come forward and start a song. Others would join in after the first line. Singing solo was still probably my worst fear of all, especially into a microphone, but my guru was before me, radiant with strength and poise, so I almost dared not bring such a base impulse as insecurity with me. When my turn came, I felt only the oneness of the girls around me, like a safety net or a comfort blanket. These were the ones I had looked up to for years, yet I felt not an ounce of competition or haughtiness from them. Such feelings had only grown roots in the mud of my own jealous mind. In reality, there was only sweetness, humility, and love. There was only one team, and all of us were in it. Anyone's strength or victory belonged to all. An area was unofficially reserved for us at the front of the bleachers, so we could respond as one if the master called us. He would often start the evenings by walking or cycling around the dusted floor of aspiration ground, in deep meditation, and sometimes we would be invited to sing at the edges in two or more groups. There were many opportunities to puff myself with pride and convince myself I was better than others, because of the attention and privileges I was enjoying. Naturally, such thoughts sometimes wormed into me when I was tired or otherwise not at my best. Usually there was no space in my thoughts to wonder what other people were doing or thinking, though, not even to note that the sun was especially hot or the rain especially wet. Focusing on my guru's activities and meditations, on my kinship with the other girls in the group and on stretching my own spiritual standards comprised more than enough occupation. There were simply two levels of kinship, a wider one and a closer one, the way one can live in a city and a country at the same time. I knew from years on the outskirts of that city that I was not inside it because I deserved it, but because it provided the conditions in which I could blossom fastest. Although I could work and do everyday things at the time, my only exercise was walking, usually as a commute to the shop. While I was glad for even that much fitness, I still felt pangs of longing when I saw anyone running. The rowing team at sprint intervals between the speed bumps on the road, the self-conscious teenager jogging stiffly on the grass, the portly businessman labouring with slow determination. Working in a running shop left no room to escape the reminders of its joys and benefits. The healthy glows and smiles of the customers were enough to show me what I was missing, even if they did not mention it. Remembering my state of living death 3 years previously was enough to renew my gratefulness, though, and enough to move any sadness to a back corner of my mind. Sri Chinmoy initiated the Self-Transcendence Marathon that August for 700 people. It would be several loops around Rockland Lake, an hour's drive away. Many of the entrants were much older than me or battled with a variety of impairments, but still made the finish line. The air was full of joyous victory at Aspiration Ground that evening after the race. Mostly I was happy for those who finished, but part of me sulked that I had never completed such a distance, and possibly never would. The runners came in turn to a microphone at the function to announce their finishing times, so we could applaud them. Over 2 hours, over 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, six and beyond. Meanwhile, my oneness still alternated with sulking. Sri Chinmoy then said if there was anyone present who did not run that year for whatever reason, but who would like to run next year, they could pass by him for a blessing. Although I had not run a mile all year and could not even imagine doing so, I certainly wanted to run a marathon, so I was one of the first to go. He meditated keenly on each one of us as we passed, and I felt an untapped strength blooming inside me. From his own hard-earned experience of 22 marathons, the master offered us encouragement and training tips over the microphone as we took prasad, urging us, as always, not to harm or endanger ourselves, only to stretch a little further every day beyond any limitations that were merely self-imposed. For me, most of his words were only pipe dreams, but as I touched my fingers to the prasad, I heard, "Start tomorrow. Run 2 miles." It was not directed at me, but to everyone. It was not an instruction even, but a suggestion for those daunted by the ultimate goal. I pinned only that sentence to the corkboard of my mind and kept the rest in a little pocket somewhere. I would try it, just that once. If I felt worse after 1 minute or 1 mile, I would stop immediately and know it was not for me. If, by some miracle, conferred by my guru's blessing, I could complete 2 miles at any pace, perhaps I could also continue beyond that distance. I had not brought running shoes or clothes with me from home, so straight after dawn the next morning, when nobody would see, I took out a t-shirt, the trail boots I had worn on the plane, and some checked shorts that were actually pyjamas, then jogged very slowly to the end of the road. Apart from feeling self-conscious, even though nobody was looking, I was fine. I lumbered over another 2 blocks and turned around, not wanting to stray too far from home just in case. I was fine. I had no idea how many times I would need to repeat that distance to cover 2 miles. At my doddering pace, I guessed 25 minutes would do. So I called it 27 to be certain. I was somewhat short of breath, but I was fine. I realised only then how strange it was to be fine. I never usually felt fine even when sitting in a chair. Tolerably well had become the norm. The remnants of my ailments had vanished. From that day until the marathon the following year, I retained my long-lost health. Ensuring I ate well and took enough rest, I gradually added steps to my weekly journey, and an image of the finish line grew in clarity. It was as if my guru jogged beside me in all my marathon training runs, like a silent coach. I felt the joy and freedom of running itself, and also the miracle that every step symbolized. Through his blessing, God's grace seemed to have cured me of a stubborn and mysterious illness. At the start of the marathon voyage itself, Sri Chinmoy meditated with the mass of entrants from a little platform and offered a message of encouragement. He beamed and clapped for everyone then, but I imagined it was all for me, for having the faith and courage to start something that had seemed impossible only a year before. I saw the master sitting at the finish line while I turned my 9 loops of the lake. He called some people to congratulate them as they completed the distance and to have a picture taken with him. If ever I caught him glancing towards me, he looked away immediately. As I grew more tired, I became increasingly fractious and focused only on the outer circumstances, on my physical discomfort and the fact that my running coach had chosen to ignore me. I was apparently alone with the challenge. I finished just after 5.5 hours, but I felt nothing, not even relief. Far from calling me over for a photograph, my guru was on the phone as I passed him for the last time, frowning and looking the other way. Finishing was a pale triumph after the treasured elations of training. It was a miracle, but even a miracle did not feel like enough. Inwardly, it did not take me long to dust myself off after that first marathon and to see my mistakes. Although it took some time longer to recover physically, God's grace still seemed to be shining, and I began to imagine entering the same one a year later. I was still cautious of exertion, and my initial zeal was somewhat tarnished, but as the saying goes amongst runners, life is as good as your last run. I knew in a running sense I could not let my first marathon memory also be my last, and the only way to delete it would be to replace it with a better one. Running seemed tied with parallel threads to the rest of living. To leave that matter unresolved would be to give up, literally and symbolically. By the following August, I was at least fit enough to try the race again. I aimed just to turn up and do my best, but even turning up was not as simple as I had hoped. Our driver got lost, affording us an extra hour to enjoy the scenery, but winding through country roads at the back of a bus was not my idea of a jaunt, especially not at 5 in the morning. Bulging with travel sickness, I was only interested in running as far as the nearest bathroom when we eventually arrived. My hair had been tied when I left home, but it decided to loosen itself and get in the way at just the wrong moment, so I then had the task of washing a sticky mess out of it by only the cold trickle of a hand basin. A passing megaphone heralded 15 minutes to the start, and I decided to laugh, especially knowing I was still at least 5 minutes from the starting line. Forget warming up, forget stretching, sunblock, insect repellent, Vaseline, carefully stashing my energy gels, or even tying my laces properly, I just grabbed my personal stereo from the front pocket of my bag as I launched it towards a tree. All attention on the state of my stomach, I was then jogging towards Sri Chinmoy's opening meditation. At least I'm here on time, I thought. At least I have my music too. Low battery, the music player replied, and closed its eyes. Other than giving up before I began, my only choice was to get on with it. Eventually I was glad of that start as it freed me from all expectation. Joy began with me and it continued to find me from every source. A new battery for my stereo, a cup passed. A smile, a wave, a drummer, a singer, my name called aloud with enthusiasm, an upturned thumb from a faster friend as she passed. I was not alone, but a cell in one thriving organism, spiralling clockwise around the lake. The energy of the first few laps gave way to tangible peace as the last of us jogged on through the trees. Even in the thickening heat of midday, my happiness seemed separate from my leaden limbs. Somewhere in me it could thrive undisturbed. Instead of lapsing to a frown of doggedness, my smile only broadened as the miles passed. I watched the leaves fall in a chorus of beauty, as if describing Sri Chinmoy's piano music on my headphones. Nobody was even in sight then, save a twitching squirrel or sailing swan. In the distance, the speckled mass of finishers gradually appeared from a haze beneath the trees, and I cried with the beauty of it. That night I was one of the last to approach the microphone and announce my time. Still the smile clung to me. 6:53. "Good, good, very good," exclaimed the master, with a smile to match my own, nearly bubbling into a chuckle. The race had taken me almost an hour and a half longer than it had a year before, but the time was immaterial by then. As with singing, and as with everything, I was reminded that although perfection is good, purchased at the expense of soulfulness, it is almost worthless to me. My second marathon was by far the greater victory, to me and evidently to my guru. From then I considered self-transcendence not so much an achievement as a state of being, applicable to any form of effort. Offering the self fully to a task and wanting for nothing in return bore the sweetest rewards in the end. Sri Chinmoy came to Britain twice that year and his visit to Edinburgh fortunately fell on my birthday. After a special function where he met and honoured dignitaries, there was to be a private function for disciples. I spent the whole afternoon dragging a friend around all the florists in the city centre to find what I considered to be the right vase of flowers to give my guru on my soul's special day. When our feet were throbbing from the hike, at last I found a plump handful of lilies, freesias and gerberas, my favourites at the time. They were all different shades of pink to match the sari I would wear, arranged in a simple bulb vase. Nobody else might have thought them exceptional, but to me they were potentially perfect. In the hotel lobby I proceeded to take the imperfect and overly fussy stems away, to leave a rather sparse clutch of sprigs. I trimmed them further and moved them about for another half hour, defying anyone who came within 6 feet of my craft and bearing the brunt of more than a little friendly teasing. It was not so much the result I sought, but more the root, the intensity of a working meditation, the striving for heavenly perfection through an earthly medium. I went to the hall early and was allowed to place them on a table in the master's private room, along with a little card. The table, complete with flowers, was brought into the main room for the second function. Prasad was carried in at the end as usual, with the names of 4 people who had offered items for their birthdays. The master called one girl and meditated with her, and then said, "Family, come." I thought he had said, "Emily, come," and although astonished, I stood to go. The friend next to me saved me any further embarrassment by gently pulling me down again. While smiling photographs were taken of the family with their guru, I just wished I could hide in a hole somewhere. How could I have been so presumptuous? Even as the family returned to their seats, I was still silently chiding myself. "Emily," came Sri Chinmoy's voice quite clearly, but I did not trust my ears. "How many years?" At last, with confirmation from my neighbour and a few other pairs of eyes on me, I was standing. "6, Guru." "Only 6? Come." I came and stood in front of the stage where the family had been, looking up toward the master's chair. But he said, "No, come here," pointing to the table next to him. Presumably, as I was only one person instead of a group, that was the most practical place for him to confer a blessing. If only I could have flown to a simple happiness on the wings of my heart. Instead, my mind seemed to present a catalogue of complications. I did not want to be taller than him, but there was no way of lowering myself without blocking my view. The table was covered in drinks and other paraphernalia, and his jacket was folded on a footstool next to that, so my only option was to stand. It was an honour I would only have dared imagine in my dreams, but in reality I just felt the hot self-consciousness of standing on stage before hundreds of people. The master had pulled out a gerbera from my minimal arrangement, and his hand rested on the side of the chair with it. We were already meditating. Again, the force and fullness of an ocean wave washed into me and around me, so I steeled myself just to stay on my feet. His eyes were the wheeling galaxies I had first seen so many years before. Time and thought dissolved in his smile. He reached the flower up to me, keeping the stem a moment longer, so we both were holding it. Then he let go and bowed his head with folded hands to the Supreme in me, as I had only seen him do with others. "Usually this is for over 7 years," he said into the microphone. "This is a special case." A special case? Me? On some level I still felt like the strange skinny child who did not fit in the world, someone to bully and misunderstand. It would have been enough for me to consider myself ordinary, but special was in a different universe to any I had visited inside my own skin. I gripped that dear flower in silence as I walked with my companions back to the hotel, dodging crowds of drunks and partygoers, straining to assimilate or understand what had happened, let alone begin believing it. Eventually a thought arrived as explanation, the same thought that had helped me countless times before. The guru gives only what is needed, not what is deserved. To proceed up the mountain, I needed to see the Supreme in myself, the self my guru bowed to, not just the unreachable god on a cloud with a long white beard, not just the clod of inadequacies and imperfections that I called self. In the same way as the master gave people spiritual names, names of their soul's qualities, high names of gods and goddesses, names of exquisite divinity to remind them of the divine in themselves, he was reversing patterns in my own self-perception that I had reinforced and let others reinforce for at least a lifetime. "What can I do to grow into this truth?" I asked him in my heart that night. "Since you have gone out of your way to teach me, how can I keep this gift of teaching always, and how can I remain grateful for it?" "Just give, and give, and give," came the answer, clearly and immediately. I knew it must be true, even if it came only from my mind. I strove always to live by my guru's example, and giving was all he ever did. Just that one tiny maxim was enough instruction. The people I looked up to most, the people I loved most, were the ones who gave and gave, starting with my mother, the day I was born.